This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today on the program, we air a conversation with the representative of Utah's 1st Congressional District, freshman Congressman Blake Moore. Representative Moore ran in the 2020 election after beating out 12 other Republican candidates vying to fill the seat of former Representative Rob Bishop. He later defeated Democratic nominee Darren Perry with 69.5% of the vote total and was sworn into the 117th Congress on January 3rd. Jason Perry, director of the Hinckley Institute, moderates today's conversation with Representative Moore and discusses Moore's first days in Congress, his policy goals, and the future he envisions for Utah. This forum was recorded on February 17, 2021. Here is your moderator, Director Jason Perry.
This is going to be some time well spent as we have a chance to have a conversation with Congressman Blake Moore. And this is going to be a chance to hear from one of our brand new elected officials here from the state of Utah. And Congressman Moore, you've been a friend of mine for a very long time, so I know you well, but I would really like a chance for the people out here in the state that don't know you as well to really get to know more about you, how you got to this position. And there's going to be some things about this position that are going to be great to talk about today. I'm not sure I know of any newly elected member of Congress that has done more in their first couple of weeks than you have here in Washington, D.C. already. But take just a moment, if you don't mind, and introduce yourself a little bit to me. And I'm going to be disappointed if you don't talk about your quarterback scholarship to Utah State before you went to the U. People might not know that.
It won't take very long because there's not too much to report. So that'll be an easy one to cover quickly. I'll highlight, you're right. This has been a very eventful 6 weeks starting off Congress. And as I texted you something earlier, we had a quick check-in about today. I looked back and above there on my text message and it was dated, I think it was dated December 28th, where I said, hey, I won't hesitate to ask, this is going to be a wild ride. And I was right on that. I had no idea it was going to be this wild of a ride going into this. So, yeah, looking forward to talking to you all, giving you a little bit more context or an inside look into many of the things that I've experienced and that I've been a part of. It's been some very tough moments, that have caused me to reflect lots and some harrowing experiences. But some really great things with respect to, creating relationships with people back in Congress, some amazing Americans that are out, willing to do this work, a lot of good mentorship that I've been able to get and go through some tough experiences and some tough votes. And then the committee assignments, it was like the bright shining star. We were so excited about where we landed with that. But just as a brief background on me, and I'll try to keep it brief. And if there's other questions, I'm happy to address it. But more importantly than my redshirt freshman year up at Utah State, I didn't get to go back and play at Utah State, which was really disappointing. I served a mission for my faith in South Korea. And during my mission, my coach was fired. And so the new coach came and sort of cut all the missionaries that were out at the time, like several roommates of mine. So there's three or four of us that were freshmen together and some other folks. I think there was like even a dozen that we kind of lost our scholarships. This stuff happens. It was a bum deal, but it gave me a chance to go live in Ephraim, Utah. And I went and played at Snow College and got to experience a lot of what, I've lived on the Wasatch Front my whole life, and going into living in rural Utah was a neat experience. You just have to, sometimes you can't control your circumstances and you just got to roll with it. And it got me back up to the U where I was. Everybody in my family graduated from the U. My parents are both Utes, and I graduated the youngest of five kids. We all graduated from the University of Utah. So I graduated in 2005, but when I came to Utah, my first semester was during the Olympics, right? So I had this awesome internship at the Department of Economic Development for the state of Utah, and got to experience that. That was a really great moment. I will be very, very supportive. I'm hopeful that the Olympics could come back to Utah at some point. And I'm hopeful that that's something that can happen. But born and raised in Ogden, Utah, I was 17 years old. I won this national award called the Wendy's High School Heisman. That's probably more significant than the scholarship that I had. But it was an award that was given out by Dave Thomas. He wanted to highlight high school seniors that were, you know, for three areas: athletics, obviously, academics, and citizenship. So a male and a female win it each year. And the citizenship part was something that I reflected on a lot lately. An Eagle Scout service project, all the stuff I did with church and the community type of events and from extracurriculars and school, all of that went into this sort of application that I was nominated for by my guidance counselor. And we ended up, you know, I got to go, you know, we won it that year. I got to go back to the Heisman ceremony for 25 years. It's been a really neat thing as a college football player, like something that has been pretty awesome. I got to go the year Alex Smith went. So I know that he became, if you didn't hear about him from many of these students that are in school now, probably don't remember, you know, remember his days playing at Utah, but they did see a guy that had 17 surgeries stand up again and play this year. That was probably, let's say, the best story of 2020, which is a low bar, I understand. But anyway, so a lot of that type of stuff. So I'm married, my wife, Jane, we have three little boys, 8, 5, and 5. So we have twins. You know, so just a bunch of little league that we find that I still find a way to make work. And we just, you know, we're, you know, enjoying this phase. My little boy, Winnie, he was tested on the spectrum. We've been giving him a lot of, you know, interventional behavioral attention over the last few years. He's doing awesome. So, you know, you have all those life things that come up. Meanwhile, it was a year ago. It was just middle of January when an old friend of mine suggested, you know, my mom worked for him he was a Weber County commissioner. And he said, hey, you have a unique background to support Hill Air Force Base. Hill Air Force Base needs, you know, someone that can go and establish themselves in Congress and serve for some bit of time. You know, even though you're turning 40 this year, you're still relatively young. I don't feel that, but I guess I am. And that was what initially sparked my interest in whether I should do this. But I have a master's in public policy that I got through Northwestern while I was working. I've you know, been involved in political matters before. I worked for Dan Jones, which was a real honor for 7 years. I worked for the prominent pollster of Utah, and just kind of seeing the way he approached and thought about issues was really, really a neat experience. One of the last conversations I had with him before he passed, you know, he kind of walks in the office. He's, you know, he's in his mid 80s, still dressed to the nines, was there every single day until he got too sick. And, you know, just kind of looked at me one time. He said, Blake, in his gruffy old voice, he said, don't wait too long to run. And I'm like, I don't know if I'm going to ever run for office, but I am interested in, you know, in doing some good. You know, for those little moments, it all built up for me. So when somebody suggested you should give this a shot, and like all those things came rushing in, and then we my wife and I made a decision with some fun negotiations there. That prepared me for anything that I'll have to do with Speaker Pelosi. I mean, these are hard-nosed negotiations. There was a short time frame, right? Like I was the last to enter the race, so the election season was going to be short. So the risk to running was relatively small. Cicero was going to be okay with me coming back to work. I made sure that was clear. Sometimes it's really tough to run for office like this in the middle of your career, right? That's why you see oftentimes politicians running for other political posts. So to kind of just jump ship in the middle of it was a risky thing to do. So my wife and I had a lot of really, you know, good chats about this. And I think the ultimate thing for her was, all right, the risk to running is small. The risk to winning is large. If you win, then that's a big change in our life. And I'm going to need a little more help around here with the kids. And I was like, deal, Nancy, deal. You know, so we joked about that. Her name's not Nancy. I'm joking about Speaker Pelosi. So, that was my first big negotiation, and I'm sure there'll be more.
Well, Jane is great, of course, as you mentioned, and I know you did have these hard conversations. As you talk about that and your experience that led to this decision, one thing many people don't know is about your foreign service experience, which also has helped you not just already in this position, but will with these committee assignments you've received.
Yeah, absolutely. I got to I have a unique background. So I'll talk briefly about the two items from my background that are not what you would necessarily say, oh, that person is going to run for office. But when I think about it, and now that I've been involved, when I made my case for committee assignments, and I tell them my international experience, I tell them my management consulting experience, working in teams and you know, going through this process where you have experts who are my clients, mm-hmm. and I go and I help them to, you know, create a strategic framework or help them with some data collection, and we go and try to achieve, you know, what their ultimate goal is. I mean, that's the way I view a lot of this sort of committee work that you'll do in Congress. But correct, I have a background with the U.S. government, and like many, you know, I speak a second language. So there's a lot of recruitment from the State Department, the FBI, Central Intelligence Agency. They all come to the University of Utah. They all come to BYU. They come to Utah State. And so I was able to secure, you know, some interest from some of those. And later, a few months after I graduated and made some inquiries, I had the Department of Defense gave me a background investigation where I went and worked in some contracting work. Eventually got to go in to live and work in Southeast Asia, and in and out of China. And then back was doing some additional, kind of like what you call it, home base service back in Washington, D.C. before potentially going out on another tour. And, I remember we had just had Max at Georgetown Hospital. So our first baby, it was hours before Hurricane Sandy hit. A few weeks later, we're home for Christmas, and I randomly interviewed with Cicero Group. The big questions that we had after that Christmas break, Cicero offered me a job, and the questions were, it was either going to go to Manila, Phnom Penh, or Salt Lake. And my wife loved that third option by far the best. I'm more of an adventurous. I love, you know, the world and look forward to more CODELs where I can go and experience more international work. But it was the right time for us. And I came back to go work at Cicero Group, which is a management consulting firm here in Salt Lake City, again, where Dan Jones was partnered with that firm. You know, spent 8 years working in every industry you could imagine, from trash and recycling to molecular diagnostics up on University of Utah's campus with some of those companies there on Research Park, to education with George W. Bush Institute, to a nursing school. So healthcare, education, transportation, I mean, you name the industries, you know, management consulting can sort of touch on that. Many of you that are, you know, considering where your careers are, you know, consider it. You get to work with public, private, and nonprofit sectors across the board. That's probably what I love the most about it. And when I was interviewing with Randy Shumway for the final interview that fateful Christmas time in 2013, he said, "What's going to keep you interested in this? You know, you've obviously got a pretty unique job. You just got back from Singapore. Like, what's going to keep you interested in this?" And I said, "For some reason, I have not been able to choose like this one industry that I want to work in. I love the fact that, from what I can tell, you work in virtually every industry. You have a skill set that can be applied across the board." And he looked at me and he goes, "You're going to love it here." and when I went into his office 8 years later and I said, "I'm thinking of running for Congress." And he said, "Is it a matter of if or when?" And I said, and he goes, "Is it a matter of, for you and Jane, is it a matter of if or when?" And I said, "I can sincerely say, I think it's a matter of when at this point." Lots of data point, lots of, you know, things have led up to my life to be able to do this. I think it's a matter of when. And he said, "You have to do it now and I'll be your first contribution." So I have a lot of respect for mentors in my life. He's one of them. You know, it's been the right decision, and I hope to continue, you know, working through these challenges and do some good back there.
That was Utah's first congressional district representative, Blake Moore. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Today we are airing a conversation with freshman Congressman Blake Moore on his start in Congress, legislative positions, and the future of Utah. Here again is your moderator, Director Jason Perry.
So as we talk about that path to this particular office, can we talk about your first 2 weeks? You alluded to it a little bit, but let's talk a couple like really big votes, certifying the election, the impeachment. Talk about those two and your experience, because you are right there through both of those experiences and also the rioting, right? The storming of the Capitol.
Yeah. I could cut me off and I'll try to be brief too. And so, because I want to be able to engage, the votes that I took in the first few weeks, this from many, many veteran members of Congress just said, this is unprecedented. This is something you'll never see. And then at the same time, Kevin McCarthy looked at us and said, but you may have to vote on a declaration of war at some point. And I can promise you that is so hard. That is something that is so difficult to do. And it was kind of a neat way to sort of put into perspective. This was leading up to the very first vote. So I have a million thoughts on all of this. And so I'll try to keep it a little confined. And if I were to want to talk to a group of engaged, interested, college age folks, thank you for being that, all of you that are out there listening to this, and thanks for being engaged and interested. It's going to be important. You are the future. I feel like I can halfway represent, you know, the next generation of Americans. And I've always have that as a piece of focus. Anyway, that's beside the point. What's important to remember is how much context matters. On some of these votes, I didn't have any more context than every one of you watching cable news shows. There was no additional context. Everything was, it was out there. And on some of these votes, I had enormous amount of internal discussions and motivations and understanding of why things were the way they were. So I'll just quickly break down the certification vote. It it sure overshadowed swearing in. And that's unfortunate because that was going to be a really, really special day. And I was extremely stressed. I was back there with my wife and son and my mom, who was by far the best campaign volunteer that I had. And it was just that the Friday before swearing in, we had, we had a big conference meeting with the entire GOP, with the House members, you know, discussing this, going back and forth. Then you saw things starting to play out. You saw Senator Hawley and a few other, a couple senators say, oh, I'm going to object. And nothing happens unless at least one senator decides to object in this situation. And at that point, something very, very interesting happened. And this should probably be a case study. I would suggest Hinckley to consider something like this. See what happened when that moment hit. One of two things happened in the Senate and the House. In the Senate, some senators, backed away from the idea of objection. And in the House, more Republicans joined on to the effort. Why was that? Why would that be? I think there's lots of factors, and I'm happy to opine on it, but I'll let you all sort of, think about that. Maybe worth, your forums and discussions. But that's what happened, right? The majority of House members joined in, and the majority of senators backed away from it. The interesting thing was, and here's what I will say, it's very sincere when I say that on Tuesday, we met as a GOP conference, and everybody got to go that wanted to and share their opinion and thoughts and how they were going to go about approaching this vote. And that's when I actually gained a very good understanding of those that were going to object. At the heart of it was election integrity. And the thing that I was most worried about was that those that weren't objecting were going to be deemed as people that didn't care about election integrity. And that was couldn't be further from the truth. And that was one of the biggest things that was stressing me out, because I knew where I was on this. And I went through the rounds and I went through the proper all the discussions. And what I ultimately came back to was that we have a strong separation of power between the Supreme Court and the executive branch. We don't have as that doesn't it, House, the House of Representatives and Congress per se. It doesn't. It's it, that is not as clear as it is with SCOTUS. And you think about it, SCOTUS is lifetime appointments. Members of Congress have to run for office every 2 years, right? There's just different dynamics that exist within Congress that are going to motivate people in different ways. So it was across the board. People were, you know, this, we need to stay, you know, this was the Republicans this time. This is the part that's so baffling to me. And I can probably say this with as much credibility as anybody, because I chose not to object and I chose to certify the election, is this was done by the Democrats several times. In 2005, it was done. It wasn't done to this level, but it was done to Ohio, which I believe could have changed the outcome of the election, right? Didn't gain traction. It wasn't a big movement. It wasn't covered very much. This was, and I said it in my House floor speech. I said, look, this precedent has been set. It's been done before by the Democratic Party. It's been perpetuated by us this time. We have to rise above this. We cannot continue to go on this road. And I appreciate McCarthy, Leader McCarthy, for suggesting that we need to address reform on this particular piece of the Constitution. And we need to clarify this so this doesn't continually happen. Because I've got very, very big concerns of precedent being set and this just being a thing every 4 years. And that is not what our role is. So I heard lots of constitutional arguments one way or the other. I aligned that this was not Congress's role. Unless there was two slates of electors sent from these states, this was not our role. Chip Roy from Texas, I think, articulated some of that very best, in my opinion. You know, I'm on the side of somebody that's considered one of the most conservative members in Thomas Massie, right? And so this wasn't a test of conservatism. This was a test of where you believe your constitutional side is. Others that are just as conservative were on the other side and felt like they needed to do this. It was. What you call mental gymnastics. Absolutely fascinating. And then of course, you know, the riots hit. So I knew where I was on it. I sat in there, and as the debate started, and I'll just briefly tell you a couple things from the riot, from my experience. As the debate started, sometimes when there's going to be long debates, members will go back to their office and just watch it on C-SPAN. I decided this feels very monumental, and I'm very passionate about the way I feel about this. And I wanted to, you know, hear this out, because I've heard from a lot of my side's perspective. I hadn't heard the Democrats give their pieces about it. So I'm going to sit in and listen to this. And I'm glad I did. Right. Because I have a really amazing, you know, pretty unique story to tell as well, having been in the House chamber when it happened. I went up, sat in the balcony with several of my other members. They asked us to sort of spread out as we were going to get into this debate. And so I was up there just kind of listening in. All of a sudden, I walked out to the window. You could kind of look and peer out to the front. And another veteran member kind of looked at me and he goes, "They look closer than I've ever seen a rally or a protest before. This looks a little ruckus, a little bit raucous. Like it kind of, there's a lot of energy out there," and saw some police officers running somewhere. I'm like, wow, this is, yeah, but whatever. Yeah. No way. Like they're just going to be angry out there. And anyway, so we go back in and sit down. And then a few minutes later, all of a sudden I'm starting to get text messages from a lot of people, the team in particular, and they make an announcement right as they come in, and the House administration folks, staff members start shutting all the doors, which was a little weird because they usually didn't have to do that. That was kind of weird and a little eerie. And then they told us to sit down and get out your gas mask. And so they're like, things just elevated. And they gave us Capitol's been breached. So we'll come back with another announcement. Just stay calm. You're like, okay. So that was the moment I could call Jane. She's like, "I'm seeing this on TV. What's going on?" Getting a ton of text messages. Of course, half the text messages from my friends are like, "Are you okay? Is everything all right?" And the other half are like, "Hey, how's that new job going? Hey, you like your new gig?" You know, so plenty of that levity helped me get through some of it. But to wrap up here, they started debate again. After we had learned kind of, you know, like, okay, this is tense, But they started debate again. So we're like, okay, things are fine. It was a few people, maybe, who knows? And then I'm getting word that the Senate chamber had been, you know, overtaken, and there's pictures of people inside there. And the probably the scariest part was when the police rushed in. That's the part where you feel like you'd have no control. You've got a gas mask. You've got the police there barring each one of the doors. You have members of a few people. Of course, they were Texans and an Oklahoman. Love them. They're good colleagues of mine. They stood up and barricaded the door, the only real entrance, I guess, they could have gotten in. There was guns drawn. It was pretty tense. And when you don't have control, it was you know, very, very harrowing. A lot of commotion, and like, we got to focus everybody. We got to get some of the elderly folks. Once they told you could egress, it became sort of like, okay, I now have some control. We're good. We're all moving together. We got through the tunnel system. They were going to put us in the cafeteria. And I looked at Chip Roy, who was with at the time. I'm like, look, Chip, like, I pointed to my pin. I'm like, we're the target right now. We cannot all go back in there and sit there in this glass fishbowl. We can't do that. And he looked at me, goes, oh, you're right. I'm just going to go back with my team. So I buzzed up and went back up with my team. We hunkered for a few hours. Actually, it was an opportunity when, in hindsight, being, you know, looking back on it, it was a good opportunity to gel. We're a brand new team. It was interesting. So, it was scary. There's, you know, I was frustrated at President Trump's response. I was frustrated at the way he, treated, or he spoke of Mike Pence. I think Mike Pence was, incredibly honorable in what he's done. So it was quite an experience. And then what was funny, and what I think is important too, leading up to that vote, for 2.5 days, we got just constant calls, hoping, saying, demanding, suggesting that I object and that I not certify. And then the next 2 days, all we did was get calls that said, thank you for not objecting and certifying. And so it's mental gymnastics. And it's, you know, and then they continued on with other things. So let me pause there.
Well, I really appreciate hearing that story. I know everyone wanted to hear that. I can't even believe this experience as people are storming the Capitol building. I'm so glad that you are safe there as well. And we're watching it from home, I guess, like all the people who are sending you text messages, wondering what's happening, making sure you're safe. And one thing I was curious about, too, when it came to the feedback you get, which is always interesting, you hear from one side and then the other in this kind of order, typically based on what you the way you vote. But when you are looking at this situation here and you're trying to think about your vote, it sounds like you are not given a bunch of extra context, but otherwise, you know, other than what we saw as well. So how did you go about deciding about that vote? Were you getting, you know, what kind of pressure did you get from internal, from your own members, from your party, from others? I'm really curious about that.
For the objection vote?
Yes.
Yeah. It all happened very fast. Right. So I started to see it take place over the weekend leading up to swearing in. And then I was able to meet with leadership, you know, individually, 10 freshmen go in and be like, what have you done? What do we have in front of us? What is going on? And the you know, just kind of explaining how it all came out. So you got a chance to talk to leadership. Like I said, this is where I relied heavily on mentors, people that I had met with and gotten to know before, who I find be really, really objective, thoughtful people. Dan Crenshaw, somebody that, you know, we connected over this really well. Right. And it was helpful, and I'm very appreciative of people like Chip Roy for making the constitutional argument. So you could see it both ways. And so we really dug into it, and I had private meetings with people, a GOP conference that wasn't tweeted out very much. Sometimes a lot of things get leaked from there. And so what I know was getting reported on the press was very different in about everything here. I can't emphasize enough. I did gain an appreciation for those that did choose to object. This was not something that only our party has ever done. And we get blamed for that a lot. And I'll stand up for that. But I sincerely don't believe it was the right choice. That's why I made the decision that I did. There was pressure, but it wasn't really, it was never pressure from anybody from within. Leader McCarthy, you know, you have McCarthy, Scalise, and Cheney, and they all voted differently, right? And I think that's something that can actually represent a more diverse way of thinking. It doesn't have to just be one way, you know, per party line vote. a lot of that happens in DC, and I'll get to that. But I looked at Speaker Leader McCarthy and said, does the way I vote affect my committee assignments? I'm here to help to support Hill Air Force Base. That's still my primary focus. And it's like, oh, absolutely not. And actually, that was clear. That didn't, the way people voted on impeachment, anything, none of that affected the way that your committees work and all that. So just being able to clear some of those things from the barrier was helpful, so that I feel like I could go out and make my choice. I made the decision that I did. It's that process was very different than the impeachment vote. Mm-hmm. Like I was flying back to Washington, D.C., getting my very first FBI briefing. That FBI briefing was on CNN and Fox while I was flying on the TV screen, no different than anybody else. And so I used a framework to make these decisions that I hope I can continue to use. You won't really be able to tell what type of principled politician I can be until, let's say, I'm in the majority. And will I still make those type of principled decisions, right? So for this, it's a very high bar to remove a state's electoral votes, to object to a state's electoral votes. It's a very high bar. Impeachments needs to be a very high bar. We had 48 hours to make this decision. I didn't know what and who knew when, what. Did anybody in the administration know if there was people that were armed, ready to go? I mean, like, all of those questions remained unanswered. Speaker Pelosi knew that they could get all of their members to vote, so they were able to do that. I've never once said there doesn't need to be accountability. I saw the accountability a different way, and so I signed on to a censure resolution. The 14th Amendment was being discussed. All of these different options of constitutionality and what could actually be done in this situation with only 2 weeks left, that was all going on. And so I just used a framework that said, I need to remain objective. I went against my party on the first vote. I'm going with my party on the second vote. But that's not why I'm choosing it. I'm choosing because I needed to be a high bar. I needed to be able to have the justification to be able to reach that high bar. And again, that framework took me in the minority and in the majority. And it will kind of, hopefully I can continue on with that process going forward.
Yeah, no doubt that you will. I hope we can get to these committee assignments you talked about here in just a moment, because you are on some significant committees. But there's one question from the audience I'd like to give to you now too, because it gets to the heart of this, as you just explained. Sometimes you were with your party, one time you were not on this one, sticking to your own principles. But the question is that you campaigned on working across the aisle to get things done. To what extent do you feel like that has been possible so far? And what barriers to bipartisan action have you found?
Thank you. Let me recommit and reemphasize what my commitment is to it. And I can highlight an article that was just released last week by Roll Call, where about three-fourths of the way down the article, the author said, and many members of the Democratic freshman class highlighted Blake Moore as somebody that they could potentially, co-sponsor legislation with. That was a badge of honor for me, because I went out of my way to go make relationships. It is all about relationships back there. And none of that affects my conservative principles. It does not affect that at all. And I'm working on tearing down that barrier. And there is a lot of people that are. Now that we've started committee assignments, I was just on a committee hearing today, an enormous amount of, good decorum and civil discourse. That is good. And there's relationships and there's a lot that's going on. You will not see it necessarily in the press much, but it does exist. What I will say though, is it is going to be a lot harder than I thought. And when, if we could rewind back to November, 2020, the administration was going to change to a Democrat party. The House, the Republicans didn't lose a single incumbent seat and picked up more than was expected, creating the most narrow margin in history. And the Senate was close, but it looked like at least David Perdue would be able to go on and win win his runoff election. And I believe that if they had used ranked choice voting to get him over that 50% threshold, you all in the Hinckley, you can figure out if ranked choice voting is the right way to go about. I'm going to leave that one to you. it's worth considering. There's things to consider there. Some states have implemented it. Is it important to get over 50% when you have multiple candidates in the race, more than two? Had Atlanta or Georgia do that, I believe that Purdue probably would have gotten more second place votes. But over the course of those 2 months, a lot of Republicans stayed home from voting. Those third party voters probably went and supported Democrats and ended up losing the Senate. So in November, though, you have the narrowest margins in history, right? Not history. Don't quote me on that. But very, very narrow. That should be a mandate to from the country. Congress, you need to work together. There's definitely going to be a few Democrats that are willing to come on to, you know, Republican policy making with respect to energy or agriculture and things like that, that a lot of people can agree on in a lot of cases. But with the events of the last few months, and the Senate flipping, it's given, you know, the Democrats will look at this next 2 years a little differently than maybe they would have if they hadn't lost the Senate. It would have been, there'll be an opportunistic time frame to go, hey, well, we really believe this is the best way to approach COVID. We really believe you go really large in this package, and that will help. You know, I'm listening out. I'm listening to that side of it and willing to accept that's the way they view it. I would view it differently in many different cases. I would have hoped that we could have come together on something again. So it is going to be tougher to have that bipartisanship. It's getting right now. With the ability to use a budget resolution to get some of this through the Senate, it will be on. Now, the Republicans used budget resolution too a few years ago to get what they viewed as the tax policy that, you know, so it's so much back and forth and going on. But with a Democrat House, Senate, and administration, I am not as hopeful that there will be more bipartisanship. I'm willing to still commit to it and try and do what I can, but That's the reality, I think.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I will say that I've been impressed by is how much influence our delegation has in Washington, D.C. From you, from our other members of Congress, from our senators. You know, sometimes they're on opposite sides of the votes, even most recently. But it's interesting to see what kind of impact the Utah Way has in Washington, D.C. And I'm kind of curious how you've observed that. We talk about it all the time. And from you giving your first floor speech, which I was happy to be able to watch from here in the state of Utah, to our other members of the Senate, it does seem like we have maybe an outsized impact on policy in D.C.
We do. I don't. The Axios just reported today that three of the top 10 cities in economic recovery are Ogden, Provo, and Salt Lake. Logan and other areas get highlighted as small cities that are doing really well. I don't know if we're just kind of emboldened by the fact that we have a really good makeup. We have a very diverse economy. We're a strong economy, but also the most philanthropic state. And there's so much good that comes out of Utah. We'd be emboldened to go do that. I would say, though, to pinpoint it, right now we have Chris Stewart on Appropriations Committee, one of the most important committees in Congress. John Curtis was there, 3 years? He's been there 3 years and just got put on Energy and Commerce, one of the most important committees. There's four A committees, right? Like they rank them in these ways of jurisdiction and everything. It's Ways and Means, Appropriations, E&C, and to some degree, folks will consider Financial Services there. We have, you know, those two are on those two top committees. I was able to, as a freshman, get my top two picks with Armed Services and Natural Resources. Very, very important committees to Utah in particular and my district. And Burgess was placed onto Judiciary, which is, control. It just has so many things involved elsewhere. You look at Orrin Hatch, you know, the impact that Orrin Hatch had as a longtime serving member, pro tempore at some point, right? I mean, we've got a good track record. I think there's a good reputation. We don't really become big time celebrities, but I believe that, you know, I walk into any committee, steering committee, members office when I was, you know, trying to lobby to get on these certain committees, is you have to make your case and you have to push for it really hard and then, but not damage your reputation. It's a delicate balance. And I would walk in and say, look, I'm not here for the tweets. I'm here for the committee work. I want to roll up my sleeves. I want to be the most prepared person in the room. And just, we have that reputation back here. And that obviously gets missed quite a bit. Because, I'm not, this is the kind of stuff I like to do. I like to spend an hour on the Logan radio the other day. I'm not a big national, I've only done one like national interview on C-SPAN, right? And I enjoyed it. And if that's more of my shtick in the future, great. But we try to focus and keep what's important and really dig into the specific issues. And Utah has a good reputation there.
Absolutely right. Well, can we talk about that House Armed Services Committee? You look at your district, the first congressional district, the northern part of the state, and one key part of that district, which has been protected by members from that district for a long time, from Jim Hansen to Rob Bishop, and now to you, which is what's so impressive. How big of a deal is it for Hill Air Force Base and that incredibly important part of our Utah economy that you got put on this very important committee?
I did a full immersion tour yesterday at Hill Air Force Base. And it would have been tough to be there without being able to secure a spot on Hill on Armed Services. So I was thrilled to be able to do it. Winning a few extra seats on the Republican side, it helped the ratios a little bit. We weren't confident that we were going to be able to get on. It's a very requested committee, especially among freshmen. I think there was, for the 2 years ago, there was only like one or two freshmen that got on it. We had several more this time because our ratios were healthier. So it is a big deal. And what the reason why it's a big deal, and I'll get a little policy wonky here for a minute, is Hill Air Force Base exists under the DOD, obviously. But there is unique elements to each base that, they need congressional support. It's a competitive environment, right? And there's always the looming concern of BRAC, where base realignment takes place and closure, base realignment and closures that takes place. It's this big concern that people always have. Hill Air Force Base is in a great spot. The Utah Test and Training Range adjacent to it provides, a real strong value proposition. And so our job in Congress is to make sure the training range has what it needs and that the F-35 contract is strong and that that exists here at Hill Air Force Base. The sustainment work that we do on it, most all F-35s come through and work with the software engineers at Hill Air Force Base. And so all that kind of comes through, Layton, Utah, right? It's a nexus for it. And the entire Minuteman nuclear deterrent, there's three sides to the nuclear deterrent. One is through submarines, one is through air, and one is through ground, right? And this ground-based strategic deterrent, GBSD, is the nuclear silos that, that deter other countries from, conflict with us. And so we're going to, redo that from the Minute Maid, which is currently in existence. And over the next 7 years or so, we're going to, it was only supposed to be in existence for 10 years and it's been in existence for 50 and the infrastructure is low and we need to rebuild. So our job is to build these priorities into the National Defense Authorization Act. And that goes directly through the Armed Services Committee. So we can go and lobby and make sure that, interests of Hill Air Force Base are prioritized. And that's just kind of in a little bit how the system works. So
that was Utah's first congressional district representative, Blake Moore. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. In this final segment, First Congressional Representative Blake Moore answers questions from the virtual audience. Once more, here's your moderator, Director Jason Perry.
Take just a moment to get to one of the comments from our viewers as well. You're also on the House Committee on Natural Resources, which is also a significant committee, particularly for issues here in the West, which are not always considered, it seems, maybe by those on the East Coast. And so talk about how you're going to be able to use that position to help the uniquely Utah issues.
Good. I'll be brief here so we can get to some of these questions because they're excellent. I can see them right here. The coolest part about this particular committee, the ranking member of House or Natural Resources is actually flying in on Friday to attend John Curtis's climate change summit. Mm-hmm. He wants to make sure that from the Republican Party, we are presenting solutions and not just being like a, you know, no to the Green New Deal. It's going to, you know, no to this. We want to be providing solutions, and he's been a leader in this. And so I can't highlight the great work that he's been doing. So he's got like 25 members of Congress coming in. I'm taking some of them to dinner on Friday. We're excited. And we've got a ton of snow too, which is great, but they're all coming in for a summit where we're going to have a day and a half of just policy discussions and, you know, working with industry leaders in this space. I'm coming up with good solutions. My job on natural resources will be about balance. How do we balance our environmental needs with making sure that, you know, we can leverage our natural resources, right? Essentially is what it is. There has to be balance here. It feels like there is really good discussions going on. We're just in a waiting game right now with respect to President Biden's moratorium on public land. We'll see how that ultimately comes out, but I'm working with Department of Interior and trying to develop relationships with folks so we can go and just create, you know, reasonable policies that are good for Americans that will get to the heart of what we need to do in the environment. One thing that really doesn't get portrayed is the industry itself, oil and gas, these industries, they are trying to stay out of head of any and all regulations. And they're doing everything they can to balance that. USU Basin Campus out in Vernal, like, works directly with oil and gas companies out there monitoring air quality measures. And there has been many advancements made. Technology helps here. How do you go about balancing and then investing in renewables? Like, it's all has to be a part of the equation. And so I think on that committee, that's where we get into those topics mostly.
Perfect. You mind a couple more of these audience questions?
Please.
You got a lot of people watching with some good questions coming in. I'll go to the next one that I see. Do you consider current and planned levels of federal spending and debt problematic?
I ran on two big topics. I want to, you know, strong economic recovery, but we have to have a reversal of our debt of our deficit first. We're sitting at $28 trillion and counting. This is not something that we can, you know, just come out of. Like, I ran continually telling people about 1997. I talk about it like it's this, you know, this unicorn of a year. It was within our lifetime. Like, those of you on the call, like, it was within our lifetime to see the Clinton administration and a Republican-led GOP House work together and create a balanced budget. I have, you know, I Director Panetta, Secretary Panetta, Leon Panetta, he led that from the administration side. And if you want to read a really great book, read Worthy Fights by Leon Panetta. He's kind of a centrist. He was a congressman for a while, and then he served in an enormous, many, many different capacities, honorably, I believe. And I now serve alongside his son. His son, Jimmy Panetta, is in California. One of those relationships that I'm developing with folks from across the aisle. And then Newt Gingrich and John Kasich on the Republican side balance the budget, and it's doable. It just takes discipline, and it's going to be a lot harder now that we have so much interest that we're paying. And so I think the framework is, you know, you do have to first grow the economy. You have to establish growing the economy. But what we've missed for the last 20 years is a president that is, so, you know, focused on getting us back to that balanced budget that the Clinton administration was able to do. And there had to be compromise because he then was faced with a Republican House. And so it forced that compromise, which is good. It should happen. We have to get back to it. There's plans every year to do it. You grow the economy, you get entitlement spending and reform done in order to address it. And that doesn't mean just a bunch of spending cuts. It means, you know, thinking about Social Security in a different way. Do we have to raise the age? Is there more private sort of incentives that we can do to get people to save on their own versus, you know, creating a big structure? There's so many things that are going on in that space, but you get entitlement addressed. Deficit spending is, or discretionary spending needs to always be on the table as well. We need to be able to look at our defense budget. I'm on House Armed Services Committee. I will be one that says I've lived and worked under a DOD budget before. I know there is waste. I know we can find ways to improve. And at that point, once you get that underway, then you look at revenues again, in my opinion. If you just raise revenues, it will continually be good money going after a bad cycle, and you'll never be able to get out of this debt issue. And so I'm sincere that I want to be a part of this reversal of debt culture. I ran on that principle. I'm joining groups that are talking about it and working on it. And hopefully we can come together.
Mm-hmm. Talking about some of the impacts on the economy, you have a question from somebody asking about your thoughts on the Restaurant Act, which, of course, money set aside, introduced in the Senate, passed there for some relief for restaurants.
So this is what I've constantly harped on. Targeted aid, right? There are many industries that were fine. There are many industries that did better during this. Many people's incomes did not change whatsoever. Targeted aid is things we have to do. Restaurants, hospitality. Right when the pandemic hit, like, it was an emergency. We had to shore up the agriculture community. There was PPP loans that were used effectively. But as we continue on, we have to be able to find those areas that need specific targeted aid. Congress was never able to decide and agree on what it would be. The Restaurant Act, if I don't understand it, I haven't read through it. So I will say this naively, without having dug into it, restaurants were hurt big by this, and that creates, and that ultimately then goes and hurts lower income people and exacerbates the problem. And that's where the focus needs to be. So I like that we can kind of pinpoint that.
All right. One more question from the audience, and then I want to do a wrap up with where you see things going here in the future. The next question here is the RNC has announced an election integrity committee. Any thoughts about how to improve election integrity and reduce fraud?
So I said back in August that, I have concerns. States were ramping up mail-in balloting measures very quickly during a pandemic, right? And this is my point on everybody on January 6th cares about election integrity, no matter whether they voted. And I know, and I can say that with sincerity from at least my party. And so I have many concerns. And what I keep telling people, what I've offered countless times, come to Utah. We've been doing this since 2012. We have really strong measures in place. I spent 2.5 hours at Weber County Elections Office in late December during the holidays, because I knew that this conversation was continually going to be going on. And I just went through their process with them and asked them how to do it. The burden of proof of voter is shifted in our process now. Before, you would show your ID, you would then get your ballot, stuff it in the ballot, and be done. Right now we're doing a ballot, and then the way, working closely with the driver's license division, there's a way to verify all that. It's done in just a different format, but it's done very well. And Utah has an incredibly good process. So on this, this type of committee, like, I have offered numerous times, like, come talk to Utah. Dan Crenshaw even put it in his podcast. He goes, Utah's had a really good process. I think it was because I nudged him on this one. And so I want to be, however I can. You want to be involved in everything. You sometimes just don't have the time. But we need to make sure that Americans feel comfortable and confident with where things were. I hope to be a part of that solution.
Okay. Just the last 5 minutes, if you don't mind, Representative, you've already co-sponsored 11 bills, maybe more since the last time I looked at that, which is a pretty good number. Talk about the things you want to get done here, things on your plate right now on behalf of the state of Utah that we're going to see from you over the next coming weeks and months.
So in particular, when I was interviewing my legislative team, I had asked the question, like, hey, what would you want to get? What do you see as some priorities that we need to do? And there was a really cool idea that was presented. We're working through it. We don't know what kind of potential it has, but we're working through it. And I think it would be something that would be really productive, and it should be able to get bipartisan support. many things done at the federal level become overly bureaucratic. It's just a reality, right? I'm a strong believer in the 10th Amendment. I believe states, because I'm from a state that does things, many things so well, I believe that there's a lot of options there. And I think that healthcare could be better addressed if we were to have more control at the state level and education across the board. That's what I loved about Every Student Succeeds Act, is that it actually decentralized some of it and it pushed it back to the states. One thing we're considering is creating a pilot program with federal student loans and maybe block granting them back to the states and letting the states, letting a few different states run this and see if they're, you know, how well they're able to do it based on certain parameters. We've had people give us ideas on what needs to be addressed here. And so we're thinking along those lines. And this is obviously things related to natural resources and armed services are going to be top priorities for us. And so we want that. Those are sort of given, to be honest with you, though, although we're working, that's where the majority of our time will go. But if we could go and improve a way that we address federal student loans, keeping it affordable, keeping it so, you know, students can go and engage in an education community. I want to be a big proponent of workforce development. Like, what does the industry need and how can we backfill our educational, you know, institutions with the right type of regulation that would allow for that to take place more easily. Like, we see a lot of industry leaders in this, and there are many in Utah. I mean, if I look at what, you know, Utah's educational institutions are all doing from across all of our universities to our community colleges, to our tech centers, we are focused on the jobs of the future and building and helping education, you know, get along that route. There'll be more one-off opportunities because they won't necessarily be directed to my committee work, but it's something that I care about. And I think can, you know, a strong economic recovery comes from skilling up our workforce, educating our workforce. And hopefully we can jump onto a lot of those initiatives.
Well, that's great. Great answer. I'll tell you, when you think about jumping in, you know, sometimes in the past, there's this time where you kind of you wait out for a little while before you start swimming. You had no chance to do that. You got thrown right in. And I got to tell you, from the state of Utah, we appreciate what you're doing out there. So glad you're safe and that you're representing us so well. This has been a great opportunity for our students and people to watch this conversation with you, Representative, because you represent such an important part of the state of Utah, something as a huge economic driver, but so many other things as well. Thank you for all you're doing. And thank you for being with us today.
Thank you all for engaging. This has been an honor. I love doing this, so I appreciate it.
That's our show. If you'd like to hear our other local programming, you can find it on our website, kcpw.org. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your producer and host of this program. As always, thanks for listening. Thank you.